In the old version of Write Publisher Pete, it used to be Write Publisher Pete, get your books out as fast as possible. It's a little bit different now. How is it different? We're going to talk about that. What's next beyond repeating? And what Sean and I would do differently if we were just starting out now.
Write, publish, repeat. It echoes through the air. A chorus for creators. A call to those who dare. With cookies as his compass and a pen that won't retreat. He journeys through the pages. Write, publish, repeat.
Hello and welcome to Write, Publish, Repeat, episode 9. What's next beyond repeating? So this first season of Write, Publish, Repeat, we've aimed at new writers and walking you through the process of writing your first book, or maybe you've been around for a while, but you just want to make it, you want to streamline. So this final episode of the season is about, you know, you got your book done. What now? What's next? And we've got Sean Platt with us. No guest today. It's just us.
they've turned on us. No one wants to be on the show anymore.
Yeah, we called around like, yeah, no thanks. No, that's, we just wanted actually, to make this.
That's not actually true. We planned this one out, and we actually had a fake version of this one yesterday. So we got on, and we didn't really have the topic ready, and so we rebooted. Dave went back to the drawing board, and we came back today because the question is, you know, the repeat model isn't what it used to be. And so how does that change, you know, because it's not 2012 when, you know, Write, Publish, Repeat was very straightforward. A lot has changed in a decade plus. And so the question is, how does repeat work now in 2025?
What are we repeating actually? Like, are we slowing down the process of, you know, getting books out? Are we spending more time on the other stuff?
Yes.
All right. Show's over. All right. Thank you. It's been a great first season.
So there's two things there. I never stopped producing. So there came a time when for Sterling and Stone, it just became less profitable to focus on standalone books that I kind of wanted to write. It was all about series. It was all about KU. And I've written my share of series and I've written my share of KU for sure. But just the stuff that is, you know, like Sean Platt books that are books that I would define as books that I would write for free, you know. And
is it the Realm and Sin sort of like big out there sort of things are you talking about? Or
yes, but really anything. So I love writing shorts because you can just kind of like jump in and explore an idea, but it's hard to market shorts, right? How do you do that effectively? Americana is a really good example. Okay, so just here's some examples of books that I've written that didn't get published to Amazon because the amount of time, energy, and company expense that would have been required to focus on those and make those books successful would have been disproportionate to the books and series and storytellers within the studio that are easier to monetize and get momentum for. And you know, we are a community, like we're a business for sure, but the more storytellers that we can get working together and, you know, monetized in little like pockets, that's kind of amazing for everybody, and, you know, including us as a studio and our ability to publish more works and sell more IP and kind of keep that flywheel turning. So, you know, Johnny and I have known this from the very beginning, that being genre hoppers with only our names, you know, as the common denominator or some themes, you know, a particular voice, that's a very difficult way to grow algorithmically for sure. But it doesn't mean that I ever stop thinking about those stories. Those are the stories I actually want to tell. That's why I got into it, right? There wasn't there were algorithms in play for sure when we first published Yesterday's Gone, but it was a totally different thing. The amount of competition was totally different, and the machine learning wasn't what it is now, and there wasn't like Amazon ads, Facebook ads for books weren't really a thing. So
and that's kind of all the, you know, all the behind the stuff things you were talking about a moment ago. Like, we couldn't put all the expense, we couldn't justify all the expense of the other studio stuff. That's what you're talking about, like the ads and the
So here's an example. If we have a we have storytellers at Sterling and Stone that just have incredible read through rates. Meaning, if somebody gets to book 2 or 3, they're going to get to book 6. And if they get to book 6, they're almost for sure going to get to book 12. And we're talking like absurd numbers, like 94% read through, right?
And is this all in KU or just in general? Like,
no, this is KU. This is KU.
Go on.
But that means that you're going to, it's earned, right? So if you know that this, the average reader is going to get through this series, then book one gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to market, right? Mm-hmm. Even if your ad cost goes up, it doesn't matter because your the value of your customer is just so much higher. Contrast that by one of my favorite things that I wrote in 2023 is a book called Americana. Right now, at the time of this recording, you can get it for free on the website and on specifically my site. It's seanplatt.net/Americana. So if you're curious about this book, you can download it for free there. And it's always available on all the YouTube videos that we drop, but it's not really, I'd rather give that book away than try and sell it on Amazon. But it was a big idea book. I was watching this documentary about the Amish trade and just like, you know, basically tourist trade up in some of these Amish communities and how there's just rampant sexual abuse and it's ignored because it's inconvenient to disrupt the tourist trade, which these communities depend on. And so, like, how do they justify looking the other way? Well, because that's just the way it was back then. And I got kind of obsessed with the idea of like, oh, well, man, what if there was a theme park that just celebrated the way things were back then? Except the way things were back then is right now, and it's 150 years in the future. So we have like, you know, we can remove ourselves and look with some perspective.
Oh,
and
God.
Like, that's a really cool premise. So Americana is a theme park. So it's like,
is this a thriller or satire or what?
It's a thriller. And I would have actually made it more satire, but Bonnie had a heavy hand in this book and she's like, you need the right container for the reader to, you know, get pushed through. And so there's a liaison from the Commonwealth, which is visiting the free frontier states. So it's 150 years in the future and we're all like up in Alaska now because
it's like Jurassic Park, but without dinosaurs.
America right now is arid. So we're all up in Alaska and it's divided. It's the free frontier states and the Commonwealth. And so Diana, the main character, is a liaison from the Commonwealth, and she is taking her family on a vacation to the free frontier states, and they're visiting the Americana theme park. But she's really there on a diplomatic mission, but her family doesn't know this. And just from the moment you pull up to this theme park, it's obvious like what's happening, right? There's a restaurant called Monroe's where every single waitress is dressed like Marilyn Monroe and done up in full Marilyn Monroe. And so there's just like, it's kind of immortalizing American culture, but like the things that are really fun and vibrant and not the inconvenient truths. And so,
we got skinny Elvis, not fat drug addicted Elvis.
Yes, it would be a skinny Elvis. That's very, very good. So I love this story, and conceptually I think it would make exceptional film or television. It's that kind of IP, but I'd rather just give it away and get numbers on it and not really play the Amazon game. And so that was the way I was approaching it, you know, for basically the last year or so. And then when I got back from Author Nation, I'm like, oh, well, this could be something that we sold directly. Like, it could have a really cool edition. Like, it's the kind of thing that could get true fans for sure. I just don't want to work that hard to get such limited results. If I'm going to only have smaller results for a book, I want a deeper connection then. Like, I want to make that trade. So essentially, I never stopped writing. When I got back from that trip to Belize and I wrote 6 dick bags in Belize, you know, when what's another one? The one I just, that's out this month, Plot 147.
Yeah.
That was me and Catherine. We're just passing the story back and forth every day. I'd write a chapter. She'd work on the chapter and give me some notes for the next chapter. And we just wrote this thing because we were both had a lot of work that we were doing and it was kind of an escape. And so those things now have a place to go. Like, I can think about it differently. And, you know, ever since we started this year and we had the commitment, let's hit YouTube every day, you know, it's we're we're looking at the landscape of what can we put out, and there's a whole bunch of stuff. The book that's coming out next month is Six Dick Bags in Belize, but the month after that is a book that was written a few years ago and not even under my name. And because, well, oh, that's super literary and that's going to affect what we're trying to do with your name. Well, it doesn't matter now. Like, so I'm going to sell that book direct. I'm going to put my name back on it. And it's one of my favorite things I've ever written. It's actually Bonnie's favorite book that she's ever participated in. And it's really cool to get that out there. So I think in this post-repeat days, you have to think differently about what repeat means. And it's not just doing the same thing over and over. And that's what rapid release, the era of rapid release was about: hit your genre and your market every single month until you burn out. And like, or you get so successful that you start to resent it. Like, even the good stories were sometimes like, oh, right? And I don't ever want to be in that situation. I want to be in a situation where I feel really passionate about the work that I'm doing, because otherwise it's just a job. Like, I don't want KU to be a job. I want the things that I do to be rewarding.
I've talked to many romance authors that do very, very well, and the number of them that don't want to write romance, like, they want to write some other thing, but they know it won't sell as well, and they feel sort of enslaved to that genre. So what you said, like, you know, it just made me think of that.
It's shocking. I mean, and I do agree that it's more so in romance than any other genre. But I mean, we have a client base of people who we're carrying on their series because they don't want to do them anymore. They're like, this is lucrative. Every time I put out a book, it makes money. I don't want to write those books anymore. And it's like,
I think an author can easily get bored with their own stuff. So it's not a condemnation of the story or the genre or any of that. It just, like, some people are just ready to move on to something else, right?
Some people are absolutely ready to move on. And also some people, like, the genre that they're born to write is not the genre that they had success in, right? Or that, like, it's very, especially if you're going into the space in a write-to-market mentality, you know, which I am saying as a positive term, you know, like, hey, I'm thinking about this as a business. I'm going to write to market. I'm doing my research. Here's the areas where I can write to market. So I'm going to do this one. And then you do that and you're successful, but you're not really enjoying it. Like, you're writing, and writing is definitely better than pouring concrete, unless you pour concrete and that's your thing, which is awesome. I'm not judging pouring concrete.
No, it's a bitch of a job on your body, man. Like, yeah, for me, my dad's done that.
I wouldn't want to pour concrete. I really like writing, but if I'm writing things that I don't really care about, which I have done, of course I have done that. I've done that many, many times. And it's not like I did it and then learned not to do it. I've done it as recently as a year ago, you know? Right. So that's just, it's part of figuring it out. The difference is I don't stay there. Like, if I experiment with, you know, some KU stuff, I don't know if you, I don't want to say the name of the book because it just doesn't matter. But there was a book that I wrote kind of like on assignment because it was for a specific genre and I could fit the pen name and I did it. And I was so miserable. I was so miserable writing this book because the genre itself, like, just put characters in positions that I didn't really enjoy, like, writing them into or out of. And I did one book and I'm like, no. And I think that it's important to know what you resonate with. And if you, it doesn't get easier over time. In my experience, not just personally, but anyone I've ever talked to about this, if you start down the path where it starts to feel off, right? Like, I'm not really enjoying this. You don't learn to enjoy it more over time. The disconnect only grows, and then you really start to resent the work. And how can the work not suffer? Like, so who's winning? Like, you're creatively not winning. You might be, you know, business-wise winning, which is why you keep doing it. But to my mind, that's scarcity. That's thinking, I can't have the same success in another area. I have to keep doing this thing that I'm not really happy doing. And I don't think that's worth it, personally.
So, for repeating then, what are we repeating now? Are we repeating a different thing? Are we? So write, publish, repeat was always like write, publish, repeat, like do the same thing over again. So what are we repeating now? Like a different section of this?
Yeah, well, we're definitely repeating. So the creative goes nowhere. I'm absolutely repeating. I still have my writing routine. My writing routine hasn't changed at all. My output has only gone up, actually. But I'm not in a hurry to publish anything. I'm perfectly content to finish a book. And I tell myself, I just bought cheap stock in my idea, and this piece of IP that I've created, just because I didn't publish it, doesn't mean it loses any value. In fact, it's like aging wine or meat or anything else. Like, I've created the thing that now has value, and I'm going to put it over here to where it can gain interest, because I feel like Americana could have been just another book that I put out in the market and it tanked. Right? Because we've had plenty of those. You know, we put them out in the market. We don't have the proper amount of launch energy, and we just don't get the momentum, and then it plops. And there's no value in that. It makes way more sense for me to do nothing with it and wait until the appropriate time, or put it out for free and just get readers. Because readers, when it comes to IP, readers are actually more valuable than buyers because they're easier to come by. If I got 1,000 readers for Americana, I'd be like, yay, I sold, you know, 1,000 books. But if I got 100,000 free readers, which would be easier, that's actually more exciting to anybody who might be looking at Americana to make a TV show. So it's a different way of thinking about it. The other thing that I think is really important to repeat that gets lost, it was always a part of our message for sure, but I think it really got lost in the transition from our repeat culture to the rapid release culture, which is that you, every time you're going out to learn something new. So Johnny and I did a lot of genre hopping, but we also did a lot of experimentation. We also were always trying something new. Okay, this time we're gonna try something different with the layout and the images that we do in the books, or we're gonna try a different platform this time. We were always, always experimenting. And I would compare this to the way that Bonnie teaches people to self-edit their work and get better and better and better. And she always suggests that you don't just edit your work by going through and, okay, I'm going to fix everything. I'm going to fix all the dialogue, and I'm going to fix all of the description, and I'm going to fix all of the emotional moments. And that's a hard way to edit, and it's also a hard way to learn, because you're not really focused on anything. You're doing 8 different things on every page. Then by the time you get done, you haven't really connected things the way you could have, and your learning is a little bit all over the place. Where if you treat the passes as separate, okay, this time I'm just going to focus on dialogue. All right, now I'm just going to focus on scene setting. Now I'm just going to focus on emotions. If you take those as separate passes, your work is better and your learning is better as well. And I think that publishing is like that. Like, focus on doing one thing. Okay, with this book, I'm going to focus on the coolest print edition possible. And that's where we are right now. And, you know, it'll be interesting to have some of these Write, Publish, Repeat episodes 6 months from now, where we're going to see the result of this. So this month, we put out Plot 147. And actually, this is fun. We can say this today. Today is the launch day. Not when you're hearing this, but when we're recording this, it's February 12th. And February 12th was our launch day for putting out the Plot 147 audiobook. So it's free on YouTube. And the first episode comes out today, and it's just a chapter. So it's a chapter every day until they run out. And hopefully we'll sell some books with that. If we don't, I'm okay with that, because I'm still getting the book out there. I'm getting my name out there. I'm getting Catherine's name out there, and we're building a profile, and we're hitting, you know, new books every month. So we can have a different kind of game strategy than the average author. But the point is that every author should have some sort of a strategy, like know what you're doing, know why you're doing it, and treat it in passes. So this time it's all about, like, we were wanting to experiment with audiobook. Last month we wanted to experiment with songs. Well, not we, Dave wanted nothing to do with it, but I wanted to experiment with songs. So John Titor has an album, which actually hasn't been out there publicly, but there's 4 songs from the album, or 3 songs from the album that are out there. Next month, there's a couple things we're experimenting with that are, we're still figuring out, but every month will be new things. And we've also experimented with book trailers, which we haven't done in many, many years, but now that we're on YouTube, we're trying something different. And our direct sales site is still so, so new that we literally just put a shopping cart in yesterday. So there's really not much to report there. But the point is that we started this year knowing that we were going to do that. January, it was just about getting live. And so we didn't have a direct sale. The second book, here's how we're repeating, right? So every month we're doing something, but we're not just doing the same thing over and over. If you're repeating by doing the same thing over and over, right now in 2025, you will not get results. You will be, you know, you will be laughed over and over. So in January, it was just important to start the flywheel turning, get the YouTubes going. And if we had waited until we had a perfect website to start getting on YouTube, we still wouldn't have either. And so now, okay, now we have some YouTube traffic. It's not a lot, but it's there. So now let's get a site up. And now the site, as of today, it has audiobook for sale and it doesn't have an audiobook for sale. It has audiobook for free and an ebook for sale. We don't have print yet. We haven't even started to figure that out because we're, you know, doing this little piece at a time. But next month, when our third book gets out, I'm sure that we will have print available. And then we will also be able to go back and add print for Plot 147. And, you know, by the time our fourth and fifth and sixth book, you know, whatever comes out, we have really big plans for books in September, October, and November. And by that time, we'll have rhythm. We'll know what works. We'll be able to do some beautiful print editions for those particular books. Americana is slated to come out on July 4th because of course it is, you know, and you know, actually make it for sale for the first time instead of just being a giveaway. And I would love to do something really cool with like a hardback edition for that. And if we tried to do that right now, it would be stupid. But if we did that after we already learned three books before that, how to, you know, iterate, I think that's what's important, is that the repeat includes experimentation. It includes being bold. It includes asking yourself questions and like pushing what you can do, because it's like stagnation is always going to kill a career.
Now, a lot of what we're doing is intellectual property play, like to, you know, get interest from Hollywood and stuff, where we've already sold scripts and we have inroads, we have an agent and all of that. For a lot of people that are just starting out, though, that might not be, you know, what their goal is at the moment. So in what ways could they apply a version of what we're doing to like building readership or whatever to push forward?
I think that maybe a great way to reframe this question is, what would I do if I was starting right now?
Because, I actually,
that's perfect. Let's pretend that that's what you asked just now.
Yes, that is exactly what I did.
Because I think that that's the real question, because yes, it's easy. It is easier for me in some ways. I have the muscle memory to write constantly. I also have such a back catalog that I'm not afraid of just stacking stuff up. I've ghostwritten for enough people. I've written for enough things that didn't go anywhere, in addition to the things that had the success I wanted. I had enough things that didn't. So I'm not like attached to any project. So again, I'm doing the things that I would write for free. It's okay if they go in.
And you write a lot of stuff.
And I write a lot of stuff, right? Like it's part of how I think, it's part of how I process. So that's just easy to do. But if I was
Just a side tangent here, I wonder if at the end of the day, when your career is over, will you have written more than any human ever? I feel like that's a legit, you could do it.
Yes. Okay. I think that if AI hadn't come along, then yes, I think that's very possible. Like I'd at least be in the top 10. It's very hard to say what people are doing around the world. And there's like, you read these amazing stories about like, there was this guy who had done this, he'd spent his whole life like building this giant fantasy epic world that never went anywhere. And this, you know, there's just
I've seen stories. That.
And I don't love know that. What people are doing, but yes, I have written an ungodly amount of things, and I really love the process. So I'm not looking to create less. but I'm looking to create smarter. I'm looking to partner with different people so I can make different things that I couldn't make myself. And so, yeah, I've developed a lot of confidence in what I can do and what it needs to, how it needs to perform to make me happy and all of that. And if I was just starting out, I would not have that. But if I was starting out right now with nothing, no network, no friends, no collaborators, nothing published, but I had the earned wisdom of the last 15 years, so that's where we are, then what I would actually do is treat my author business very separately. So here's how I make money, and here's how the art I create. And so the art I create would be all about getting fans for it. If I wanted paid customers, then I'd be very conscientious about not giving a lot away for free, if anything, and just, you know, keeping high value on my work and, you know, getting a little more exclusive tribe, which is kind of the play that Johnny is taking. But that's not what I would do. I would care much more about exposure. I wouldn't try to do the two things. So in the artist and author Johnny camp, it's I want to be an artist author. I want to be the author, and I want to do it on my terms, and I want to be well paid for my work, and I'm going to do all the little things to make that happen over time, even though it's not fast. That would really frustrate me. Like I'm not built for that. I want to make
sure. Johnny's over there churning butter, turning butter into stories.
Yeah, it's a little slow, and I would rather have exposure. Like I would rather have more people experiencing the work. So if I was starting today, what I would do is the work that I put out there, I would want to have as many readers as possible reading it, and therefore I wouldn't attach income or revenue generation at all. Like, I mean, this goes back to the time. I mean, this is obviously something broken in me, right? Remember when I used to say Sterling and Stone is not a revenue generated business, and then I crashed us into a wall, right? So,
yes.
I get why, but I would be smarter about it now, and that's the thing. I would say, okay, I'm doing this on purpose. But the difference when I said that with Sterling and Stone is we weren't actively doing things to fill the coffers. We were thinking we can all create the art we want, and in the end, it will matter.
We were a lot of butter churning.
Yes, and that's not true. So if I was to approach the same situation today, I would appreciate that there are two separate spaces, and I would have the things that I created because I wanted a fan base and I wanted people to enjoy my art, and I wanted to enjoy making it, right? So there's that whole pocket. But then over here simultaneously, I would try to stay in the author space as much as possible, and I would ghostwrite, or I would write emails, or like anything that I could do to use words to continue to, you know, make my living so that I'm always sharpening the axe. You know, I'm staying in it. And in a way, that's what I've kind of always done, so it's not a surprising answer. But I think that a lot of people, they don't really approach it that way. And if you think about it, that was the first product that I made that I never sold. Remember Sales Letter Sellout? So for those of you listening, Sales Letter Sellout was, I had done a lot of marketing, ghosting, like course builders and stuff, and I knew how to do it, and I knew how to sell it. And so I was like, okay, it was the first summer after I was creative director for this marketing agency, and I'd done a lot of this work, and I wanted to build my own. And so the idea, it was called Sales Letter Sellout. And what I did is, it was a 6-video series, and they were long unedited videos where I would like outline an entire sales copy, like in front, like on my screen, write it, edit it, build the sales page, do all the research, everything. It was 6 videos. I'd never seen anything like this. And I sold, and the product was called Sales Letter Sellout. And the whole pitch was, if you learn to write a really good sales letter, then you could write one sales letter a month at $5,000, because especially the days before AI, somebody who could write sales copy was so valuable. So that was how I supplemented. You know, you could write a sales letter per month and then have all your other free time. So I would just go back to that exact thing. And hilariously, this was a fork in the road moment. I sold 3 sales letter sellouts within the first 10 minutes or so, and then immediately refunded all three of them and backed out. Yeah, and backed out. What would you say?
Why'd you do that?
Because I knew what that path looked like. And
that's all you'd be doing.
It's all I'd be doing. And
easy money?
It was easy money, and I'm suspicious of easy money. And especially at the time, a lot of it, honestly, I would handle it very differently now. But back then, I was a little bit traumatized because I'd just been, because of ghostwriting work that I'd done, because of some agency work that I'd done, I had seen some things that I really did not like in the internet marketing space, and I just didn't want to be painted with the same brush. I just felt like, I just didn't like it. But simultaneously, as I was building this, you and I were talking about the first season of Yesterday's Gone. And so it became a moment where, do I want to build this thing and do this thing, or do I want to tell serial fiction with Dave? And I picked telling
serial
fiction.
Do I want to be an artist or a millionaire?
Yes, it was. I did choose being an artist over a millionaire. That's a
huge sucker.
But I'm also confident enough to always believe that I'll be a millionaire someday. I want the right path to get there. And so I really enjoy the path, even though there's been some, like, you know, dark forests and thorny, you know, whatever. Like, it's not easy, but as a storyteller, I appreciate the obstacles. They don't bother me. But yes, if I was starting over, I would neatly divide my time between making money and making art and fans, and I would try to find the places where they overlapped without ever confusing that they're the same thing, because they're not for me.
So somebody that has a job that's unrelated to writing, say, you know, they work a desk job, 9 to 5, whatever, and it pays all right, they get by, would you suggest they hold on to that job and write on the side, or try to find a job specifically in the writing space?
I think that that's way too individual a question.
Yeah.
I think that you have to do what makes you feel safe, right? And so I'm weird in that I can feel safe with uncertainty.
Yeah, you're crazy. You're a true entrepreneur. Like,
yeah, like I
it's, you jump out of the plane before you check the parachute. Confident that you'll figure it out on the way out.
I definitely have a history of knowing that I can figure it out on the way down. That's true. I think that as I get older, I get more, what's the word? Like
sensible?
Yeah, definitely more sensible. It's just, there's more to risk, right? So it's like that Eminem line, I think I'm going to butcher it, but he's like, I used to have nothing to lose, now I have too much to lose, right? And it is, you have that arc, and it's not like I have too much to lose, but like Sterling and Stone went from this thing where it was just, you know, you, me, and Johnny fucking around to 40 plus storytellers. Like, that's a lot of responsibility, right? So I can't make the same decisions that I used to make. I can't figure it out on the way down. And even, you know, this new endeavor with Story Merchants, you've seen firsthand how much more careful, you know, we are with all the decisions as we're building this. We know that we're building it, and it would be downright irresponsible to not apply all of the lessons we've learned in the last 10 years of building the first business. So I love both of these businesses. One is small and agile, and one is established and, you know, like, still growing, but growing with like all these roots underground. Like, it's just it's different. And so I think that the amount of risk there, like, you don't risk that. Like, you just make smaller moves. And I appreciate that now in a way that I didn't used to. When we first started, I was like, why don't the traditional publishers do it this way or this way? Well, now I have firsthand experience as to why they make some of the decisions that they make. And so it's fun to play on both sides. But I think that if you have a good job and, you know, that keeps you safe, then great. Just be reasonable about your expectations. Maybe you don't need to make money for your art. Maybe it's okay just to make it art and just to have some people out there, you know, who are reading your work, and that's enough. So you have to know what feeds you. You have to know what success looks like. And I think the best way to put that is that success is different for different people. And I think that in spaces like this, where we're looking at what other authors are doing, we're looking at what other creatives are doing, we're somehow making a mistake by thinking that their success is what would make us feel successful. And that's not true at all. So like Michael Anderle is somebody who's been extraordinarily successful by any way that you would measure it. I would never want his specific kind of success. Like I collaborate differently, and you know, he's had amazing success, but it's not the success that I would want. But that's true of most people who are really successful, because I'm pretty specific about the things that I want to go out and do. So if you just want to like write a book a year,
and that's not criticizing Enderle's model. It's just
not what it works. No, it's not criticizing anybody. I would say like Joanna Penn, who I think is like, Joanna Penn has this amazing life where she's able to kind of toggle her nonfiction career and her fiction career and traveling. She does a lot of traveling and incorporates that into her book. That's amazing for her. Like, that's what she's been working for. That is amazingly successful. But I'm more of a homebody than that. I wouldn't really want to. I like my cozy little life. I like watching a lot of TV. That success is very successful for her. It's not for me. So I think you have to know what success looks like for you, and just be happy with that and do what you can to get there. And then you can always, you know, amplify once you have success. But I think it's very easy to measure what you're doing. And a lot of times, if you have a great job and it's paying the bills, then maybe you can reframe it and think, man, I'm appreciative that I have this job that allows me to write on the side. Sterling and Stone has several storytellers that fit that exact mold, where you know, they don't have to make a lot of money writing because they have their job. And so it's more about the art and the community and all of that. So I just think, know what you're doing and why you're doing it, and you'll get better results.
I think as someone that's worked jobs I hated and jobs I tolerated, creativity for me was like always on the side. Like, I did comics for 10 years. I wasn't making real money at that, but I enjoyed it. There was a joy there. And I think when you're working in the creative career that you have, and if it's not going well, there's a tension there. It creeps into the work. It can make the writing or the art or whatever you're doing that's artistic, it can poison it to some extent if you're not careful. When you have to make a living from the writing you're doing, and that's a large area that's out of your control. Like, you can write the best damn book, but if you don't market it well, or maybe it just, that thing fell out of fashion the month you released. There's a lot of things, variables that are out of your control, and that can be painful. So if you have another way to
make it. Exactly what happened to you, right?
Yeah. So if you have a way to make a living outside of the art you're doing, I feel like you find more joy in the art and the creation itself. If you can find success in the creating and the art and stuff, and it works well, awesome. That is the best. That's a dream for everybody. But if there's a way to somehow find a space where you can do both, or maybe work in a ancillary sort of just you're writing, but maybe you're writing nonfiction to make money and fiction as your art, your expression of yourself or whatever. And then the pressure isn't as high on you to make money at that one thing you're selling. And there I feel you're going to write a story that's more you, that's more natural. And it might eventually sell. It might be found. It might just be discovered, and you'll get money and all of that. And everything is a beautiful, happy ending. But to take that pressure, and this is just me because I'm less entrepreneurial, to take the pressure off of the actual art into just that's your escape, that's your place to express yourself and find beauty, joy, and all those things. That to me is like the way to do it if you're able. If you don't have a job you fucking hate and you just want to get the hell out of there. So
I totally agree. Did you ever read Drive by Daniel Pink?
I can't remember. I read most of his stuff. I don't remember if I read that one or not.
It's really good. And there's this whole thing, which I think illustrates this perfectly, where they have a bunch of kindergartners and they have them just create art. Just have fun. Draw whatever you want. And all the kindergartners love it, right? And they just are just drawing beautiful things, pure imagination, turned it in, everyone's participating. Then the next day they say, okay, if you draw something, you know, put your drawing over here, and then you get something from the prize box. And then so everyone draws, and they're like extra happy now. They're like, oh my God, I get to draw dragons, and I'm getting like a whistle or whatever, right? So they put their dragon drawing down, they go and get a whistle, and then the next day, same thing, you know, draw whatever you want, and then here's the prize box. And then on the third day, there's no prizes. But you can still draw if you want to.
Now half Fuck class, that!
Yeah, right. Half the class doesn't want to draw anymore. And it's just this human, like if we don't introduce the value exchange there, the value exchange actually is the art itself, that's great. But you said it. It's like you poison it. As soon as you introduce money into it or some sort of a gift or a prize or, you know, something that has value now, well, now you're doing it to get the thing. And so now,
and you're gonna second guess what you're doing. Like, well, how can I get more things?
Yes.
Or how can I make sure I don't lose things? Because the last thing I did didn't get things. So, it can really fuck with your art.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that it's knowing who you are and what you want. And I feel like it's never been easier to create things. It's also never been harder to get those things that you've created seen. It's never been easier to put those things out into the world. But it's also never been harder to get any attention for the things you put out whatsoever. So I feel like the whole write, publish, repeat thing has fundamentally changed in a way that's good. It's been purified. It's like if you're going to go out there and create the art over and over and over because you want to, that's amazing. And after a while, especially if you're diligent about it, you will find your audience. It might not be a huge audience and it might not be enough for you to quit your job, but it will be enough for you to satisfy you creatively if what you're looking to do is create things that satisfy you creatively and build a small audience over time. And I just don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, you can be a successful, thriving author and not be a six-figure author. I think those things are totally, totally true. So, for example, let's say my job was being a ghostwriter. Like, that's, I don't have companies, but I have the skill. I can ghostwrite. I could ghostwrite, you know, 2 books a year and pay my bills. I'm not a high liver at all, you know, so 2 books a year and I'm good.
Your dog food's your biggest expense.
not true. And so he is a bougie dog. He eats good food. So if I were to, you know, just want to create art for a living, then there's nothing wrong with that. I could write a couple books a year and then anything else that I put out into the world was for me. And I don't think that that's any less successful than if, you know, all of my companies are doing $1 billion and, you know, like I can fly private wherever I want. Like I don't think that that's a better life. I think it's a different life. And I think that, you know, ask yourself what would make you happy, because there is that happiness threshold, right? Where, and these numbers are definitely different now. The world has become a lot more fucked since they ran this study, but the original study was $70,000, right? That up to $70,000, money really did buy happiness. You know, you have the essentials that you need. You're not, you know, you're not struggling. But anything after $70,000, all of a sudden, it's not like if you make $140,000, you're twice as happy. And the person who makes $280,000 is twice as happy as the $140,000. That's not how it works. You hit a threshold and it's like, how happy can you be? And if you can do the emotional math to hit that equation a lot sooner without wasting a lot of frustration or time chasing things that aren't actually going to make you happy, because you know, a bajillion sales on a book series that you don't love is that's a well-paying job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like, you know, especially as, you know, we get older and stuff, time, health, things like that, things you can't buy become more important. And money does buy, you know, freedom and stuff like that. And it can, you know, contribute to your overall health. So, yeah, we're not saying don't have money. It's great. Money can make some problems go away. But a lot of times when people make more money, they just spend more money, or they buy more cars, they buy bigger houses and shit like that. And I feel like that's very short-term thinking. And it can bite you in the ass if success goes away, as success can be very fickle.
Yeah, we had somebody in a mastermind one time. I'm almost positive you were here for this one. And they were a very, very successful author they did not like the genre they were in. They wanted to be in a different genre, but every time they tried something in this different genre, it tanked. Mm-hmm. And so they were just kind of having to do this one genre over and over, and they weren't really happy, but they were trying to fill the happiness with things. And their hot seat, if you remember this, I'm going to see if you remember this. Do you remember what I'm talking about right now?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. So the hot seat was about how they could get a house in Aspen. Like, that was what the hot seat revolved around. And I didn't quite even understand, like, how are we approaching this problem? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the wrong, like, clearly there was a disconnect there, right? Like, a house in Aspen wasn't going to solve the problem of I'm not satisfied with what I'm doing. I'm just
right.
doing this. And so I feel like figuring out what is going to make you happy as a person is kind of, it's not about writing or an author career. That's like a fundamental question. Like, how can I be happy as a human? And I don't think we're asking ourselves that question enough.
Season 2 of Write, Publish, Repeat, How to Be a Happy Person, starring Dave.
Oh my God, can we do that? Can we do a very special episode, How to Be Happy?
When I find happiness, perhaps.
Well, I think that we're actually, I think you are a good case study on this, because we have, you know, like, we're looking for the things that make you happy. We're looking for the things that you're good at and that don't require you to swim upstream. And we've experimented a lot over the last decade on, oh, maybe you can do this or maybe you can do that. And a lot of times when something is like, hey, do this thing that you don't really love because there might be money on the other side of it. How many times has that worked out?
I can't remember any.
See, and so it's important to ask yourself the right questions. And we've been very diligent in the last few months about asking ourselves the right questions before we get into something. And even when we're in it, we're keeping asking ourselves questions so we don't get deep into anything that we're going to regret. And so that's the way to keep the happiness quotient high. And happiness is repeatable. Like, that's the main takeaway from this episode, I believe, is that the only repeatable thing that matters is what makes you happy, because that is
it that makes you happy.
And so, like, I do a lot of things when I know that the common thing is one genre or one business or one area of focus, but I'm more of a producer than that. And I mean that term in not like I produce a lot, but like a movie producer, but not movies, right? A producer puts all the things together. They see the vision, they put the pieces together.
Architect.
Yeah. And so for me, like, I like that. That's part of the art, is having all the ideas. So I don't think that you can be, you know, ideation number one on StrengthFinders and only do the one thing or focus on the one thing, because that kind of violates how my brain works, right? Like, I'm not about focus. I'm about, like, and I can focus like a motherfucker, you know, like when mm-hmm. I need to focus on something, but focus on a broad level on like one project, that's like, not only does that not serve me, it doesn't serve any of the people that I'm working with, because being able to come in and help you with this thing and work with Bonnie on this thing, and like, that's kind of what keeps this engine.
All right, well, I think that wraps up this episode. So be happy, everybody. that's the moral of today's
happy episode. Is sustainable.
And if you want more happiness, authorvelocity.com.
is that our, we have a
call to action.
Cheat sheet, 10 ways to be happy. And now you're going to have to make this. And
it, holy
it,
shit.
It could be a joke, but you're going to make it. On authorvelocity.com, in the next 30 days, you're going to be able to see Dave's cheat sheet, how to be happy.
How to be happy from a miserable bastard.
Yeah, that's the exact title.
Wow.
And I believe that we are going to, well, this is the end of our first season, and season two is going to get better. So Dave and I are going to
Wait, what? We're going to improve.
We're going to improve. I'm happy with how this first season went. I want to be even happier because that's sustainable. So we'll sit down and we'll brainstorm what we can do for season two. And I actually have an idea for season or for episode 10 that I'll tell you about as soon as we get off.
Oh, this isn't it? This isn't nine? Isn't the end of season one?
Well, yes, it is. So I guess it'd be season one. Well, I don't know. You tell me.
Okay.
That's a mystery box. That's a cliffhanger. We'll see All you right. either in episode 10 or in season two, episode one.
All right. Bye.
The shadows of the Sunshine State, redacted is his home. Lives a man named David Wright, who pens the great unknown. Diet Coke runs through his veins, a decoy wallet keeps him rich. Paranoia fuels his pen, and creativity's his niche. Write, publish, repeat.